Welcome and thank you for joining us for another episode of KPMG's Inside International Tax, a podcast devoted to recent developments, observations, and trends related to U.S. international tax. I'm one of your hosts, Gary Scanlon, a principal in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. I'm joined by my co-host, Kristen Gamboa, a managing director in the same group. Hey, Kristen.
Hey, Gary.
So on June 28th, the Treasury Department announced that it reached an agreement with the other Group of Seven, or G7, countries, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the UK, on a side-by-side solution to exclude U.S.-parented groups from the Income Inclusion Rule, or IIR, and the Under-Tax Profits Rule, or UTPR, of the Pillar 2 regime, in exchange for the removal of Section 899 from the OB3. In today's episode, we'll discuss this agreement, what taxpayers should expect, and its implications for the future of Pillar 2. For our discussion today, we're joined by friends of the podcast, Michael Plougin, a principal in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice, and Marcus Heland, a principal in KPMG's WNT EVS Practice. Welcome back, Michael and Marcus.
Thanks, Gary.
Thanks, Gary. Good to be here.
So before we dive into the G7 statement, let's refresh our listeners on what's transpired over the last few months. It's no secret that the Trump administration has a tense relationship with the OECD and the Pillar 2 project generally. At the outset of his second term, President Trump, in a presidential memorandum, rejected the OECD global tax deal, disavowing any previous U.S. commitments related to it and declaring it to have no force or effect in the United States unless enacted by Congress. Despite the fact that the U.S. has not adopted Pillar 2, U.S. groups could still be vulnerable to taxation under a Pillar 2 tax, in particular the UTPR. This inspired multiple legislative and executive proposals, including the legislative proposals by Chairman Smith and Representative Estes, to retaliate against the UTPR. Before the OB3 was finalized, the G7 agreement was announced, and therefore Congress removed Section 899 from the bill. Marcus, the announcement from Treasury and the G7 countries is not a binding agreement, but instead is a statement of understanding to reach an agreement. What is this understanding based on, and does the statement provide any details of what might be included in the agreement?
Yes, that's correct. This is just a statement of understanding. As you said, this is not a formal agreement, but nonetheless, I think it is a significant development, and it does signal the future direction of Pillar 2. Most notably, the statement includes a list of four accepted principles. The first is that under a side-by-side system, U.S. groups would be fully excluded from the UTPR and the IIR, both in respect of their domestic and foreign profits. Second, there was a commitment to ensure that any risks that may be identified with respect to a level playing field would be addressed. Third, there was a commitment for work on simplification measures around the compliance of the administration. And then finally, there was a commitment to work on substance-based non-refundable credits and the treatment of those credits under the Pillar 2 regime. Importantly, the text of the statement itself notes that those principles were included in consideration of a few items. So as you mentioned at the outset, the removal of Section 899 was a key part of this. But importantly, that wasn't the only consideration mentioned. The text of the statement notes the successful implementation of QDMTTs and their impact as being another important consideration of this agreement. I think that latter point is a really important point to emphasize, and the OECD has increasingly been emphasizing that in public comments recently.
Thanks, Marcus. So the statement only explicitly mentions the exclusion of U.S. parented groups. Is it safe to say that U.S. subsidiaries of foreign parented groups would still be subject to the IIR and UTPR?
In the context of a non-U.S. parented group, it's clear that the IIR will continue to apply to the U.S. subsidiaries of that group. If the non-U.S. parented group has not implemented an income inclusion rule, so if the ultimate parent of that UPE has not implemented an income inclusion rule, that then raises the question of, well, could the UTPR apply to a U.S. sub? In principle, yes, but I don't know if that's been agreed at this point, recognizing that the U.S. has significant concerns about the application of the under-tax profits rule generally.
So the statement clearly contemplates excluding U.S. groups from taxation under the IAR and UTPR, but the statement's silent on the QDMTT, through which countries can impose a top-up tax on profits that are taxed at below 15% in their own jurisdiction. Could the CFCs of U.S. groups still be subject to QDMTTs?
Yes. So U.S. groups are not excluded from QDMTTs. In fact, the text of the G7 statement itself does explicitly mention the successful implementation of QDMTTs as a key consideration of that deal. As I mentioned, in recent days, the OECD secretary that started to really emphasize this point, both in its report that was sent to the G20 finance ministers and in public comments. And it seems that the secretariat is trying to head off concerns that have been raised by non-U.S. groups that excluding U.S. groups from the IAR and the UTPR creates a potential risk of an unlevel playing field. The secretariat is pointing to QDMTTs being broadly implemented and continuing to apply to U.S. groups. And that dynamic, in their view, minimizes concern regarding a level playing field. Beyond QDMTTs, obviously the application of GILTI is another key factor that addresses any potential risk regarding a level playing field. Just out of curiosity, I looked at IRS CBC data to just get a sense of the significance of this QDMTT point. In particular, I wanted to try to figure out what is the share of U.S. group profit that is reported in a jurisdiction with a QDMTT versus non-QDMTT. And what I found is that a very large percentage of the foreign profit of companies that file a 8975, which is mainly U.S. parent groups, is reported in a jurisdiction with a QDMTT. And a big share of that comes from three jurisdictions, being Ireland, Singapore, and Switzerland. Now, of course, there's all sorts of data integrity issues with this high-level analysis. So the most recent IRS data is from 2022. So this is old data. There's also issues with some double counting around stateless. But I think the main point is that QDMTTs have, in fact, proliferated to many of the major investment hub jurisdictions. And that does seem to point to the OECD secretariat really leaning on the point about QDMTTs addressing this level playing field concern. And I think that's something that they're going to continue to emphasize as they try to scale this G7 statement into a formal OECD agreement. In light of all of that, I think a key question is whether jurisdictions will roll back their QDMTT. We obviously don't know the answer to that, but I know a handful of things in this regard. So first, at least to my knowledge, to date, no jurisdiction has provided a formal indication that it is rolling back its QDMTT. Second, given that level playing field concern that I just described, the OECD will want to ensure that QDMTTs stick around, and the secretary has publicly stated that it's working on measures to ensure behavior towards QDMTTs doesn't shift. And then a third, non-U.S. entities continue to be subject to the full Pillar 2 rules, and thus QDMTT jurisdictions will continue to have a reason to keep their QDMTT for those groups. All of that would seem to point in the direction of QDMTTs having staying power, but only time will tell. And I should note that sovereignty is a new buzzword at the OECD, and that would seem to mean that these countries would be free to repeal their QDMTT if they thought that was in their best interest. So that's a really important point that we'll be monitoring over the next several weeks and months.
So one of the United States' main concerns with the Pillar 2 regime is the QDMTT rule order. And in April, it was reported that the United States wants to change the commentary to the Pillar 2 rules to allow countries with QDMTTs to push down cross-border taxes like GILTI or Subpart F. Michael, do you think that the statement's language on preserving the tax sovereignty of all countries will help the United States in negotiating for the pushdown of cross-border taxes?
That's really the point of that language from a U.S. perspective. The U.S. thinks that the countries ought to have that tax sovereignty to give a credit for GILTI against their QDMTT if they want to. And to be fair, some countries might want to allow GILTI to go first in the QDMTT ordering rule. In other words, for their QDMTT to give a credit for GILTI, Subpart F, or branch taxes imposed by the U.S. And the point there is that some countries didn't want a QDMTT in the first place, and they didn't need the revenue, but they felt like they had to have one, so they enacted it. And if they can give a credit for GILTI, that could potentially make those jurisdictions more attractive to U.S. groups. And obviously for the U.S., it could be a significant revenue issue, but it would need to be done on a voluntary basis. Lots of countries are not going to give credit under their QDMTTs for guilty. So it's not going to be a rule that the U.S. could say all QDMTTs have to give credit for guilty. That's not going to be where this lands. But it may be that on a voluntary basis, countries could allow credit against their QDMTT for guilty or subpart F. It's notable, though, that the statement didn't just say that countries could choose to give a credit under their QDMTTs for cross-border taxes. I may be reading too much into the lack of a clear statement on that, but the lack of that explicit statement suggests to me that there may not have been full agreement on that point, even among the G7.
Thanks, Michael. Another issue that U.S. groups would face absent this agreement would be the treatment of certain credits, specifically the R&D credit and other non-refundable tax credits. It sounds like the treatment of these credits is something that will be addressed by this agreement. Marcus, is that right?
Yes, that's one of those key principles that was in the G7 statement. And this is something that the U.S. has had concern about for a long time, concern about how the U.S. R&D credit and other U.S. non-refundable credits would be treated under the Pillar 2 framework has been something that's been discussed and controversial for some time. Now, interestingly, if as part of this side-by-side agreement, U.S. groups are excluded from the IR and the UTPR, then the treatment of U.S. credits would become irrelevant for U.S. parented groups. However, I think the U.S. is still focused on this for a few reasons. So first, as we talked about earlier, the expectation is that the U.S. subs of a non-U.S. groups will continue to be subject to the IR. And the U.S. doesn't want the benefit of U.S. credits to be clawed back by that IR. And second, there likely is just a general policy point here, which is Treasury would want to ensure that U.S. credits are not treated less favorably than other countries' credits, merely because of a difference in terms of whether it's refundable or not. There hasn't been as much public discussion in regards to how this work will proceed from a technical standpoint, but nonetheless, it was in the G7 statement, and so I expect something to come out of it.
Thanks, Marcus. So we've talked a lot about IRs and UTPRs, but interestingly, one item that was not discussed at all in the joint statement is digital service taxes, or DSTs, which is one of the foreign taxes that Section 899 would have provided a retaliatory measure against. Michael, if not covered by the expected agreement, is there a plan to prevent foreign countries from imposing DSTs on U.S. groups?
That was a little surprising, wasn't it, that they dropped 899 in exchange for a statement that doesn't say anything about DSTs. The point there is that the administration is relatively clearly at this point trying to deal with DSTs through trade. So, for example, in June, the administration threatened to end trade agreements with Canada if they retain their DST, or trade negotiations with Canada if they retain their DST. It was reported that Italy was reconsidering their DST in light of trade discussions with the United States. And generally, the perception is that the U.S. trade representative has been leading the response to DSTs in trade negotiations. Now, interestingly, the G7 statement did say that the side-by-side system under Pillar 2 would facilitate having a, quote, constructive dialogue on the taxation of the digital economy. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that.
Thanks, Michael. I want to shift gears now and talk about implementation. I never progressed past high school math, but by my account, the G7 is only composed of 7 countries, whereas well over 50 jurisdictions have enacted some aspect of Pillar 2. I know that the OECD is not bound by the G7, but do we expect the inclusive framework of the OECD to fall in line?
Yeah, well, you're right. The G7 does not speak for the other 140 countries of the inclusive framework. But it's really not unusual for things to proceed in this way in the inclusive framework. Initiatives to make changes often start with a subgroup of countries. And in fact, the G7 has sort of led the way often in the two-pillar project from the very beginning. But the inclusive framework operates by consensus. So for this to be agreed at the inclusive framework, all 147 countries have to agree, or more technically, no country can object in the inclusive framework in order for this agreement to be made. And I think it's actually important for the deal to be an inclusive framework agreement, and not just, as you mentioned, the 50 or so countries that have implemented Pillar 2, Because the EU directive provides for an ambulatory definition of safe harbors that can be incorporated into the directive if they are multilaterally agreed. And it's not totally clear what that means, but it's probably a reference to guidance from the inclusive framework. And so in order to get this implemented in the EU directive, it really does need to be agreed at the inclusive framework. And that's a messy process. It's something that requires both the political delegates in Working Party 11, as well as the more political delegates and the finance ministries and political leaders in each of the countries to come together and reach agreement. And those things need to happen, really, given the timeline here, on parallel tracks. I will note that Working Party 11 does seem to be working on some of the technical questions around the G7 statement, sort of assuming that the G7 statement is the basis for a deal. And then the G20 finance ministers communique in July actually incorporated a lot of the language from the G7 statement, which indicates that that may be the basis for agreement here.
One thing I did notice about that G20 communique was, as you say, kind of largely consistent with the G7 in terms of it mentioned level playing field concerns, it mentioned work on credits, but it at least didn't have the explicit language about excluding U.S. groups from the income inclusion rule in the undertaxed profits rule. Now, it's hard to know how much to read into that, but one way of interpreting it is they clearly were looking at the G7 statement when they drafted the G20 communique, given they picked up some of the principles. So it may be deliberate that they did not have the language in there about excluding the U.S. groups from the IR and the UTPR, which may just mean that of the 13 new countries that were added to the discussion, they may just have not had enough time to consider that exclusion. But nonetheless, I think it just shows and underlines your point, which is this is going to be a complicated and messy process to scale up this G7 statement into a formal OECD agreement or even a formal G20 statement.
That's a great point. They left out the most important part of the G7 statement. So yeah, it may take a while to get everybody on board and reach a deal here.
Thanks. So what needs to happen, Michael, for the agreement to be completed? And when does it need to be completed by?
The timeline here is really daunting, right? U.S. Treasury has said they are targeting a full agreement by November of this year. And one reason for that timing is that the UTPR safe harbor expires at the end of this year. Now, the UTPR safe harbor protects U.S. groups' U.S. profit from the UTPR, which means that if a deal is not reached by the end of this year, the UTPR will start applying to the U.S. profits of U.S. groups. Now, even if they do reach a deal by November, we've seen that a lot of countries take time to implement guidance from the inclusive framework into their domestic law. And so it's likely that many countries are not going to be able to change their laws before U.S. groups start accruing UTPR liabilities in their financial statements at the beginning of 2026. So that's going to be an important thing that they're going to have to wrestle with in the inclusive framework as well as they go through this deal-making process. But reaching a full deal by November is going to be hard. As Marcus said, it's not clear that all countries are on board yet with the principles of the deal. So that's the first thing that they need to solve. And assuming they solve that, and I'm pretty confident they will solve it. They then have a lot of difficult questions to answer, in particular with respect to partial ownership structures, the scope of U.S. groups, things like that. So these are hard questions, and it'll take time to work through them at the technical level in Working Party 11.
Michael, I want to come back to something that you just said that I think is really important and should be emphasized for our listeners. You said U.S. groups may have to start accruing a UTPR liability with respect to their profits, even if the inclusive framework reaches a deal by November. So an inclusive framework deal is not good enough for just turning off the financial statement accounting impact of these rules.
That's right. The G7 statement obviously isn't law, and even an agreement at the inclusive framework isn't law. So countries that have enacted a UTPR will need to change their domestic laws to effectuate the deal. And that could take some time well into 2026. So the UTPR could have financial statement impacts for some U.S. groups if countries don't change their laws in time.
So what about U.S. groups that have a liability for an IAR or UTPR with respect to their CFCs in 2024 or 2025?
the G7 statement doesn't say anything explicit about 2024 or 2025, but the U.S. position has to be that the deal is retroactive to be side by side for 24 and 25. It's just not going to work to make U.S. groups comply with Pillar 2 for 2 years and then not going forward. One wrinkle in that is that some countries may not be able to make retroactive changes to their laws, so we'll have to see how they deal with that issue.
So as we discussed in the last episode of the podcast, Congress is mulling over a second reconciliation bill. I believe they call it Too Big, Too Beautiful, which could be completed by the end of the year. Michael, if sufficient progress isn't made at the OECD on the side-by-side system, do you think 899 could be re-proposed in the second reconciliation bill?
Well, I do think if Congress doesn't think that the deal is progressing fast enough, they'll almost certainly threaten Section 899. That's really highly likely. And I do think that some sort of retaliatory tax may be proposed as part of that second potential reconciliation bill. But I'm not totally convinced that Section 899 would be reproposed in the same form we saw it last time. There's a lot of concern in the market about the potential impact of 899 on investment into the United States. So it's conceivable, now that Congress has had some time to think about it, that they would try to rework it to focus more on hitting selling into the United States rather than on hitting investment into the United States. But who knows? 899 is already drafted, and sometimes that's the path of least resistance.
Thanks, Michael. So some have indicated that the side-by-side system can actually stabilize the international tax system. Marcus, do you think that the Pillar 2 system can achieve the stability under this agreement? And if the stability is not achieved, why would that be?
The G7 statement and the principles that are included in it are a path to stability in the current environment, at least as it relates to Pillar 2. Because keep in mind, before the G7 statement was released, the dynamic was U.S. companies were fully exposed to Pillar 2, and there was the retaliatory Measure 899 in the U.S. And so that was a very unstable environment. The G7 statement took 899 off the table and provided an exclusion for the U.S. from the IR and the UTPR. So that brought additional stability to the system relative to where we were at previously. So if the G7 statement does in fact offer a path to stability, then things that threaten the G7 statement in terms of it not successfully scaling to a broader agreement, those would be sources of instability. And so if we think about what are the factors that could threaten a successful scaling up of that G7 statement, so first, and we've talked about extensively, QDMTTs are kind of the linchpin to all of this. So if we start to see a rolling back of these domestic top-up taxes, that would, at least in my view, put pressure on that deal, and it's hard to predict what would come next. One scenario would be Pillar 2 overall could come under pressure. Another scenario would be Pillar 2 stays as we know it, and U.S. groups continue to be subject to the IR and the UTPR, which would just bring us back to step one in terms of 899, et cetera. So I think that's something to really watch, is if we do see a scaling back of QDMTTs, particularly in key investment hub jurisdictions, then there's a question as to what that does to the G7 statement. Another factor would be leadership changes in key jurisdictions over the next year or 18 months or so, which is the period of time it'll probably take for all this to be negotiated. If we do see a change in leadership, that could lead to a shift in support for Pillar 2 overall. For example, the current German government has expressed different views on Pillar 2 just in the last month. The chancellor called for a pause of Pillar 2 post the G7 statement, but then the next day, the finance minister said that Germany is fully committed to Pillar 2. So to me, what that shows is the G7 statement has led to some cracks in support for Pillar 2 and just different views as to its long-term viability. And so if we do see changes in leadership in certain jurisdictions, that could shift how those jurisdictions view Pillar 2 and their support of it. Third, it's possible that some jurisdictions that are not included in the G7 could demand a similar carve-out as the U.S. received. And China in particular comes to mind in that regard. So if we start seeing individual jurisdictions or group of jurisdictions that want a similar exclusion from some aspects of Pillar 2, then that too could just complicate the scaling up of this agreement to a formal OECD agreement. overall, Gary, my impression is that where things stand now is kind of this very uneasy balance. And so if we see changes with respect to QDMTTs or leadership in certain jurisdictions, then we could see additional instability brought back.
And Marcus, just picking up on what you said about the potential for Pillar 2 to unwind more broadly, yeah, I do think that the G7 statement provides the basis for a deal that does establish a level playing field. And if Pillar 2 unwinds, then we're back to a situation in which U.S. groups are the only ones that are subject to a global minimum tax. So I would think from a U.S. perspective, there's probably not a lot of interest in having Pillar 2 unwind more broadly.
I agree.
Thanks, Michael. Marcus. Marcus, do you think that other countries can successfully obtain a carve-out for their national champions? You had indicated that they might seek one.
The U.S. exclusion is a very principle-based. It's on the view that GILTI is a pre-existing regime. It is a robust system. And so there's a basis for that exclusion. Other jurisdictions would, to the extent that they were seeking a carve-out, would need to offer some sort of principle-based justification for that exclusion. And so just it's hard to know what that would be. GILTI is obviously, as far as I'm aware, the U.S. is the only jurisdiction that has a system like that. So if other jurisdictions were to demand an exclusion along the same lines, I wouldn't really know what the basis for that would be. I wouldn't be surprised if there is countries that are asking for that type of exclusion, but it doesn't seem likely with the principle that's been agreed up until now is GILTI is excluded for very specific reasons that I just don't think would be applicable in other countries.
If an agreement's reached that provides a side-by-side system for U.S. groups, Michael, do you think that some of the recent changes to FITI and GILTI included in the tax reconciliation bill will cause non-U.S. groups to invert to the U.S.?
No. It's pretty clear to me that companies are not going to invert into the U.S. for tax reasons. No one's going to volunteer to take on the compliance burdens of the U.S. tax system and say that somehow gives them a competitive advantage. And actually, more to your specific question, the changes to GILTI probably strengthen GILTI from the perspective of comparing it to Pillar 2. So they raised the rate, and that impacts primarily groups with low effective rates. They got rid of QBI, so GILTI now does not have any equivalent to the substance-based income exclusion of Pillar 2. So it's harsher than Pillar 2 in that way. And the taxpayer-favorable changes that they made to GILTI, which are getting rid of expense allocation and increasing the foreign tax credit that's allowable, those also actually make GILTI more like an IIR. The changes overall to GILTI, like I said, strengthen it in comparison to Pillar 2. For FITI, or now FIDE, they also raised the rate and got rid of QBI and changed the expense allocation rules. But there, the impact is really going to vary by taxpayer. And there's also the backstop of CAMTI, the U.S. minimum tax for large corporates. So the interplay there is going to be complicated. But I think the bigger point is that when we see companies domesticate into the U.S., it's for non-tax reasons. And I expect that's not going to change.
Thanks, Michael. So one of the key elements of Pillar 2 compliance is the Globe Information Return, which is first due in mid-2026. If it takes countries a while to enact a deal with their domestic law, will U.S. groups still have to file a GIR?
Well, that's possible. And in fact, that is still the law. So I think groups have to act as though that is going to be the outcome because that is what the law requires currently. But I imagine that U.S. Treasury is focused on avoiding that outcome. It would be absurd to require U.S. groups to start complying with Pillar 2 temporarily by filing a GIR and then stop going forward. And there's also the point that the Pillar 2 and U.S. tax systems are different systems that have just a lot of timing differences in addition to having the differences that we just talked about with respect to GILTI. And so the GIR is likely to highlight those timing differences. And depending on the way they cut for a particular taxpayer in that year, that may create some tension in the deal. So of course, the CBCR safe harbor probably reduces that risk for the early years. But to your point, it would definitely be helpful for the inclusive framework to announce as soon as possible that U.S. groups don't have to file a GIR for 2024, perhaps through a safe harbor.
Thank you, Michael and Marcus, for your insights into Pillar 2 and the G7 agreement. And a special thank you to Casey Caldwell for her help behind the scenes with this episode. It sounds like there's a lot of work left to be done at the G7 and the inclusive framework, and ultimately we'll have to wait and see how U.S. groups are impacted by the final agreement. As always, please stay tuned for future episodes of KPMG's Inside International Tax to stay up to speed on the latest developments in U.S. international tax. Until our next episode, take care.